The Case of the Vanishing Blonde, written by Mark Bowden and read by Patrick Garrett.
Introduction. Newspaper reporting hones an appetite for crime. Good crime stories sell. All the bad things said about them are true. They exploit tragedy. They are voyeuristic. They generally lack any broader social import, but they are unfailingly fascinating. When I wrote for the Philadelphia Inquirer back in its heyday, when it had reporters based all over the region, nation, and world, we reporters competed vigorously for the paper's limited news hole. You learn fast that a good crime yarn was a shortcut to page one. Our tall, darkly handsome Sunday editor, Ron Patel, would blithely sweep aside the most important news of the week to make room for one. He called them, affectionately, dirtballs, and would literally rub his hands together with delight as he read them. We dubbed him the Dark Prince. Ron reserved a space on the Sunday front page for what he considered the most compelling read in that day's paper, which back then reached well over 1 million readers. Very often these were crime stories, and this being Philadelphia, there was no shortage of material. There was the one about the kid who was killed when fleeing a bank robbery in the suburbs on a motorcycle. He crashed when a dye pack in the money bag exploded. He was found mangled and blue. Or the dentist who recruited two thugs to cut off half his index finger so he wouldn't be able to work anymore and could collect a big insurance payout. Or the transit bus accident that generated about 2 times more insurance claims from passengers than it could hold. Ron would strip the headlines of such stories across the very top of page one, over the masthead. The dirtball strip was coveted real estate for young staffers, and we vied for it weekly, no matter what our assigned beats. I have never lost my appetite for such tales. The incident at Alpha Tau Omega, published in 1983, is from that era. It ran on the cover of the Inquirer's Sunday magazine, an even more coveted spot. At the time, it was a controversial story in the newsroom. Given that most men, and newspaper staffs were then, even more than today, predominantly male, thought that any young woman foolish enough to attend a college frat party drunk and tripping on acid could more or less expect to be sexually assaulted, the attitude of some of the editors was, "Why are we making a big deal out of this?" There has been a significant and appropriate social adjustment since then. Incidents like the one at ATO still happen, of course. Only now they are often front-page news. Women are still being sexually exploited, but less and less is such male behavior considered somehow normal or understandable. I'm proud of the story because it got behind the binary legal argument, rape versus not rape, to grayer and more difficult terrain. Crime has been a part of my work ever since. 3 of my books, Dr. Dealer, Finders Keepers, and The Last Stone, are of that genre, and several others arguably belong to it. The Finish and Killing Pablo, about the successful efforts to track down and kill Osama bin Laden and Pablo Escobar, respectively. Crime has been the subject of many of my shorter works, produced for magazines like The Atlantic, Vanity Fair, and others. Over the years, I have seen these stories increasingly influenced and often shaped by audio and video recordings. One of the biggest challenges for anyone trying to write nonfiction with the immediacy of fiction is to do it without invention, without expanding on what can be confidently known. In the past, scenes were usually reconstructions, dependent almost entirely on the memory of participants. For a writer like me, audio and video recordings are like gifts from God. When I started as a newspaper reporter in the 1970s, it was rare to have a photo or a recording of anything I wrote about. Today, it is rare not to have such material. In fact, there is often so much of it that it poses new challenges. Years ago, recordings or transcripts existed for things like trials, depositions, and hearings. For events closely covered by news organizations or purely by chance, as with the shaky film footage shot by Abraham Zapruder that captured the assassination of John F. Kennedy and the TV coverage of the killing of his assassin, Lee Harvey Oswald, days later. Such raw material was relatively rare. Today, cameras are everywhere.